Welcome back, baseball fans, to episode 66 of the Nats GM Show, the only podcast available via the Nats GM Radio Network. The Nats GM Show is proudly sponsored by No Halftime and the No Halftime app. I'm your host, Ryan Sullivan, editor-in-chief of NatsGM.com and the Baron of All Baseball Podcasts. So what is the No Halftime and the No Halftime app, you ask? You're staring at your weekly fantasy opponent and thinking to yourself, I would love to challenge just one of his players, not his entire team. But your fantasy sports service doesn't allow you to. Now you can on the all-new No Halftime app. The No Halftime app allows you to create individual challenges using players or teams. For example, you can pit Bryce Harper versus Mike Trout, Miguel Cabrera versus Manny Machado, or Chris Davis versus Matt Kemp. Creating a challenge takes seconds, and accepting challenges is even easier. No Halftime challenges can be private or public and created for the MLB, the NFL, NBA, NHL, PGA, and other sports. Join today and get started. Real money and fantasy supremacy awaits you. And now you can also try No Halftime for free with $0 challenges. Visit NoHalftime.com for more information and to download the No Halftime app for your iPhone or Android device. Receive a bonus by entering the promo code NATSGM at sign up. Receive a free t-shirt when you make a deposit. No Halftime, where the fantasy sports season never takes a break.
This is Matt from MattsBats.com, and you're listening to the Nats GM Show.
Now, I am proud to welcome back to the show a writer at 538 and the author of the number one sports book currently on Amazon.com. The only rule is it has to work. Ben Lindbergh. Ben, welcome back to the Nats GM Show.
Hey, Ryan. Thank you for having me back.
I am just so thankful to have you on tonight. And first and foremost, want to congratulate you on the book. I think I speak for most every Effectively Wild listener that we've been looking forward to this book for a year now, and I was so excited when the mailman dropped it off yesterday. I've been waiting and waiting for him to finally arrive with the book, so congratulations.
Yeah, well, thank you, and you can imagine how we've felt waiting all this time also. I mean, we hope that many people who were not familiar with the podcast and our other writing will get the book and enjoy the book, but I personally have been looking forward to, you know, podcast people reading it more than anyone else, just because the book really grew out of the podcast and wouldn't have happened without the podcast. And of course, we've been sort of teasing it on the podcast for the last year or so. So I really hope that people enjoy it.
Have you seen your show numbers go up along with the announcement and coming out of the book, or any kind of relationship?
We certainly have had an uptick this year. It's kind of been a slow and steady rise since we started the show. I'm hoping that people will find the podcast through the book as opposed to the other way around, but I haven't been checking hourly traffic numbers or anything.
Well, the first place I really want to start kind of at the beginning when you and Sam announced this on the podcast, just mm-hmm. this all coming together. Did you guys, when you were formulating and kind of talking behind the scenes about this, how realistic did you think this was? Did you think this was a 1-in-10 shot, a 1-in-100 shot? I mean, how did you think this was really going to happen?
It seemed pretty pie in the sky at first, and the origins of this go back almost a few years now. And we told the story in the book, and I've told it on the podcast, but just very quickly, it came out of an interview that Sam and I were doing with Dan Evans, the former GM of the Dodgers, who at the time was trying to revive an independent league called the Northern League. And he was looking for franchise owners, and Sam and I sort of jokingly said on the air, we'll take one if you're just handing these things out. And we were kidding when we said it, but as soon as we said it, it got sort of serious, and we kind of realized just how fun that would be and what a great project it would be. So when Dan didn't totally dismiss the idea, we kind of got stuck on it. And Dan's league, unfortunately, didn't end up getting off the ground, and so we didn't really know where to go with this. We didn't know if we should just sort of cold call teams and ask them, and we didn't really do anything with it for a year or two until – independent baseball just kind of came up on the podcast organically, and we were talking about how we'd never been to a game even, and Sam got an email from Tim Livingston, who is the broadcaster and media relations person for the Stompers and was a podcast listener, and invited Sam out to a game. And once he got out there, it seemed like the right place and the right people and the right time. So when we first came up with the idea, we thought it was very far-fetched, but it came together and we're thrilled that it did.
Well, one of the most central characters in the book is, and I may mispronounce his name, but Phelant Lentini?
Yeah, Phelant.
Phelant Lentini.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He was your starting center fielder at the beginning of the year, perhaps maybe your best hitter, and also the manager. Mm-hmm. I believe Sam writes the chapter in the book kind of describing your initial relationship with him and kind of your first interactions with Phelant. Kind of give me what were your impressions of him. He comes off as a very kind of feisty, kind of hot-tempered guy in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I was following those early meetings from afar, really, because I was still in New York. I hadn't moved out to Sonoma yet. I made one trip out there for the tryout, which was a couple months before opening day. So I hadn't met Phelant, or Fay, as we usually called him, before he was hired. Sam had lunch with him and talked to him for a few hours, and we knew a bit about him. And really, we didn't know managerial candidates. That was kind of our handicap, was that we didn't have a network of contacts in baseball. We didn't know people because we didn't have backgrounds in the game. And so we were able to compensate for that later with stats and spreadsheets and finding players and scouring the country for overlooked talent. And that worked out in many instances. But we couldn't really do the same for managers and coaches. So we were kind of reliant on who was around. And it's funny, there was an effectively wild listener who emailed us months after the season. And he's a college coach. And he's very sabermetrically oriented. And he tries to do some of the things with his college team that we tried to do with the Stompers. And if he had emailed us several months earlier, we very well might have hired him to be our manager. And this might be a completely different book. I don't know whether it would be better or worse, but it would be very different. But we went with Fay because he seemed somewhat open-minded. He seemed like a creative thinker, and he was there, and he was a hometown hero. He's from Sonoma, and we really thought he would be the best player in the league because he had been playing in a very high-level independent league, the Atlantic League, and we figured coming from there to the Pacific Association, he would really stand out. And so we thought, well, he might not be perfect, but we don't have a whole lot of options, and if we have to put up with some difficulty for a guy who's going to be the Mike Trout of this league, that might be worth it.
And I'm skipping ahead some, but I want to stay on Fay a little bit. But kind of one of the biggest, obstacles that you guys have in the book, it seems, is kind of your decision halfway through whether or not to keep him as your manager. Mm-hmm. How did you all get to that point? Because I know that, and just trying to put myself in your shoes, that must have been intimidating as you've never fired a manager before and the newness to the job that you guys are have. How did that all? Did you finally just everybody hit a breaking point and it was just okay? We got to get a divorce kind of thing.
Yeah, I probably reached that point first. I probably reached that point before Sam did. We kind of we went back and forth for the first half of the season over what the right stance to take and how diplomatic to be and how dictatorial to be. And the breaking point kind of came. There's a scene in the book, and I guess this podcast is primarily for people who've read the book, so I won't worry too much about spoiling things. But there was one kind of confrontation we had with him in the dugout before a game where we really just intended to have a reasonable, level-headed conversation. We didn't come in with hot tempers or anything, and we just couldn't talk to him. And, he couldn't talk to us, and he essentially walked out of this conversation. And that was kind of the moment where I think everyone realized this isn't going to get any better. We're not communicating, we're not clicking. And if, at least one party here is not willing to at least stay and have a conversation and consider what we have to say, then this is probably not going to work and it's only going to get worse and we should probably just make a move now. And it helped that he hadn't quite played up to our expectations for him on the field. He was good, but he wasn't miles better than everyone else. And so we didn't think he was indispensable in that sense. And so that made it a little bit easier, as did the fact that we had Yoshi as our bench coach, who had expressed his openness to advanced stats and to our input. And so we sort of had a replacement ready to go.
And you kind of alluded to it, and it comes up in the, you know, when you guys are talking about the batting order kind of early in the season. But you allude to the fact that you and Sam didn't always get along, or weren't necessarily on the same page, maybe a better way to say it, throughout this process. How often were you all butting heads versus how long were you guys, you know, kind of on the same wavelength?
Yeah, I mean, I think we agreed on most things. We were certainly working very closely together every day. But I think, you know, anyone who's familiar with our podcast knows that we tend to think about most things the same way. And when we were writing our book proposal and planning what we would do in the season, we were pretty much on the same page. And then, yeah, when we got out there, I guess I was frustrated with our lack of progress in some respects. I think from a storytelling perspective and a narrative perspective, that often worked out in our favor. If we had just sort of gotten our way from day one and just been able to implement any idea we had, I think probably the book would be less interesting. But at the time, it was sort of hard to see that, you know, and we were going a couple of weeks at the beginning of the season without doing a whole lot. You know, we had signed some players, but we were not really pushing. And I kind of wanted to push. I kind of wanted to assert our authority from the start, because I thought that would make things easier later, you know, that if we sort of let things slide at the beginning and we let Faye kind of be the one who was making all these decisions, then if we did want to start asserting ourselves down the road, then it would be even more difficult. And I think to an extent that was true. And I think Sam would agree that we probably would have been better off if we had been a little more assertive early on. But I think that's kind of one of the lessons we learned. You know, one of the themes of the book is sort of rookies versus veterans and how we were signing lots of young players and unproven players, and we thought they could succeed, but some of our veterans were uncomfortable with the idea of people coming in who hadn't proven themselves in professional baseball. And, you know, we were skeptical of the idea that you really needed this experience to succeed, but we kind of saw it in ourselves. You know, by the end of the season, we felt more self-assured and more confident. And if we had signed up for a second season of this, I think we would have been much better the second go around, just because we'd been there before.
Well, and in the book, you make a comment when you aren't necessarily on the same page with Yoshi, the new manager, that I think it was 95%, he's going to be 95% the same as Faye. Yeah. And I think it was maybe 87% you guys would be the same as Faye at the same point.
Yeah.
Did you all ever reach the point or the feeling that we would never get along with a manager? It doesn't matter who was there.
Yeah, there was a time when it seemed that way, and we were close. I think we mentioned in the book we were close to having Theo Fightmaster take over as GM. We discussed that. He was discussing it with the owner and with his wife, and we were seriously considering that, and I was pushing for that because I knew that we could work with Theo very closely. We were great friends with Theo. We agreed on most things with Theo, and so if he had been able to take over, then I thought that would be the perfect solution. And then it was sort of scary where we went from Faye and it was sort of this feeling like, okay, we removed the obstacles and the impediments and now we can get our way and we'll have Theo. And then that didn't work out. Theo decided he couldn't handle being the general manager and the manager and the husband.
Right.
And so we went with Yoshi, and, you know, there were some hiccups at first there, where there was some sort of jockeying for authority that took place there also. But eventually there was a resolution that everyone was happy with.
Well, and as I alluded to, you said it a second ago, you and Yoshi and Sam obviously didn't get along perfectly at first. When did that relationship change? Because it seemed like at the end you guys were, you know, three peas in a pod.
Yeah, pretty much. I don't know exactly what happened there. There was just there's a scene in the book where Sam, who by that time was completely on my side and he was ready to read Yoshi the Riot Act, and he was sort of practicing this monologue and this scolding that he was going to deliver as he was driving up to Sonoma to see Yoshi. And then he went in to meet with Yoshi, and Yoshi was suddenly receptive to everything. So it was almost a miracle or a mystery from our perspective that he suddenly was so aligned with us. But I think it was partially that we had sort of figured out how to communicate better. You know, at first we were very direct, and we were asking questions or you know, hinting very strongly that we wanted certain moves to be made while we were in the dugout during games. And Yoshi, I think, sort of resented that and didn't want to give the players the impression that he was just a puppet, you know, and we were pulling his strings. And so we eventually came to a point where, you know, we would have meetings before a game, and we would talk on the field before the game and during batting practice, and we would sort of lay out scenarios, what could happen, what do we want to see happen if certain things go a certain way, and break down what happened in a previous game and, you know, how maybe we would have done something differently. And that seemed to work much better. That way he didn't feel like his authority was being threatened, and we didn't feel like we were being ignored.
That actually makes a lot of sense, particularly when you put it that way. A couple of lighter things I wanted to ask you about before we dive in a little deeper. You all play a preseason might actually be the right word, a scrimmage at the San Quentin prison.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear just what your impression was of that day. I mean, I can't imagine the scene going to San Quentin and playing a baseball game with all those, you know, you get this image of the hardened criminals and everything else. What was it really like?
Yeah, that was really something. I had never been in any situation like that. I wore jeans to the prison and was told that I couldn't because that was what inmates wore. And so Sam did the same thing, and we had to go to a Target or something and get some other kinds of pants so that we could even get in there. Yeah, I mean, our players were – some of them were, you know, visibly uncomfortable and just, you know, do we have – I mean, can we throw inside on these guys, or can we argue about calls? Are we going to get beaten up or something? And there was – really some unease. But when we got in there, it just you didn't really forget that you were in a prison. You could see the walls around you and you could see armed guards, but once everyone was on the field, it was basically baseball, you know, and the inmates were thrilled to be able to do this. I mean, they take baseball very seriously. It's kind of, you know, their outlet when they're inside and don't have a whole lot else to look forward to in the short term. They devote themselves to baseball. They put a really good team together, and they relish being able to play professional teams or college teams that come in from the outside and sort of prove themselves against these guys. And so they had a great time, and they were totally hospitable and welcoming, and, you know, nothing was threatening at all. And it was a pretty special experience. I think our players and certainly Sam and I were really happy that we got to do that.
How does the prison team talent-wise compare with, you know, maybe some – it will use the Stompers or some other leagues like that? How does the talent level compare?
Well, from what we heard, the team has an ace, but that he got in some sort of disciplinary trouble on the day that we were there, and so he was unavailable. But
likely story.
Yeah, right. Well, if true, when he is available, evidently he just sort of throws the whole game and no one else gets to pitch because he's really good. As it was, I mean, there was clearly some talent there. You know, it was like, it was probably better than your, it was like, you know, your weekend sort of men's league, but very athletic people, definitely. Mm-hmm. And people who clearly had some baseball experience and had played on organized teams before. So they were definitely not pushovers.
And now I've got to ask you about everybody's favorite player. I'm actually wearing the t-shirt now. Jose Canseco played, I guess, two games in a home run hitting or a home run derby with the Stompers.
Yeah.
It is one of my favorite shirts, I must add. What was that like? I mean, what's Jose Canseco like at 50-something years of age playing baseball and showing up in Sonoma?
Yeah, well, we were impressed by his play. I mean, the home run he hit was against possibly the best pitcher in the league, Max Beatty, and it came on a 90-mile-per-hour pitch, and he launched it out of there as a 50-year-old human being, and it was pretty impressive. I mean, he's obviously still very much built like Jose Canseco. He doesn't really run. He doesn't play the field, but, and, you know, he's clearly trying to hit a home run on just about every swing, but he obviously still has the capability to do that. So it was purely a promotional and a publicity stunt. It was not something that Sam and I did. It was something that predated us, really, and Theo's idea and his brainchild, and it worked. I mean, people came, and it generated some attention, and it was the only Stompers game that was on local television all season long. So I think it had the intended effect, but it was, you know, it was just one of those weird independent league things that you just don't see anywhere else. But at that level, there are just strange stunts and players that you forgot about who are still kicking around, and it's kind of a looser, stranger sort of baseball.
And another character I got to ask you about on maybe a little bit more of a serious note, but a better story in a lot of ways, Sean Conroy. Mm-hmm. I don't even know how to ask this question necessarily, but just what was it like having – first of all, he was a tremendous pitcher, and in the book you say a few times he might have been the best pitcher in the league. Mm-hmm. But what was it like also having his story? One, how did the team – it seemed like they rallied around him, although I don't know if rallied around is necessarily the right word, but it seemed like it was a thing that didn't become a thing very quickly. Maybe you want to share his story to those that don't know it.
Yeah, so we signed Sean based on his college stats. He went to a Division III engineering school in upstate New York and was a sidearm pitcher, didn't throw particularly hard, and so it's not a mystery really why he didn't get drafted, but his stats were really impressive, and he had started and he had relieved, and he had written a paper about, you know, clubhouse psychology, and we were really interested in having him. And he came to Sonoma and was impressive, was a really effective pitcher. And if that had been all, then we would have been thrilled to have him. But as we found out a couple weeks into the season, he was gay and he was not going to hide it, and he had never hidden it. And so that became an extra dimension to the season. And, you know, I mean, obviously it went well beyond our book, but, you know, it gives our book, I think, a depth that it wouldn't have had if it were just about baseball and stats. And it became a national story and really, I think, an inspiration to a lot of people. And there was, you know, essentially no hurdle that had to be cleared. He, you know, he announced this. He didn't even make a formal announcement, really. He just sort of told people as it came up in conversation. And you know, I don't know what people said in the privacy of their homes, but in public, when Sean was around, no one expressed, you know, any resistance to this whatsoever. You know, we sort of noticed a change in the way that people talked and acted around him for a while. The sort of, you know, insensitive off-color jokes that are common in clubhouses stopped for a while, but Sean didn't really want them to stop. He wanted to feel like part of the team, and being part of the team, you know, that involves just getting mocked for whatever it is, whatever, you know, your height or your racial background or your sexual orientation. Clubhouses are a kind of place where, you know, you could hear something every other minute that would get you sued in some other sort of workplace. So Sean just, he welcomed, you know, whatever jokes people wanted to make, and they were not made in an ill-spirited way. And so he was really just embraced by the team and welcomed by the team. And he certainly showed that he had the stuff to succeed there. And everyone liked him personally. And it really just went off without a hitch, which is great, because I think it served as an example to other people. You know, David Denson, the Brewers minor leaguer, who became the first to come out in affiliated ball last summer, he spoke to Sean before he made that announcement and sort of asked him what to expect. And Sean told him not to worry about it because, you know, that had been Sean's experience. And so it was obviously a privilege for us and a, you know, a lucky thing for us to be there and to have a front row seat and to play some role in it. But it was, I think, a great thing for all of baseball.
Can we get an update? Do you have an update on what Sean's up to now? Is he still playing baseball, or is he?
He is. Yeah, I will be seeing him this week for a New York book event. He and his family are actually staying at my house for a night, and he will be heading back to the Stompers later this month. And I would expect that he probably won't be there that long if he continues to pitch as he did last year. I think he certainly showed that he has the stuff to succeed certainly at a higher level of independent ball and should get a shot to prove that he can do that. So I hope that happens for him soon.
Oh, absolutely. That would be great. And that kind of leads me to a question that a little farther off the script, but it probably fits better here, is just how are you and Sam, do you still keep in touch with, maybe not Faye, but some people with the Stompers and the players? Do you still keep in touch, or are those relationships kind of like work friendships? You kind of keep them, but you know, they dissipate when you aren't seeing everybody every day.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are certainly – there might be players on the team I never see again. But I'm, you know, Facebook friends with a lot of them, and so I've kept in touch with them that way and sort of seen their initial reactions to the book. I mean, Theo and Tim Livingston are sort of, you know, friends. I mean, they are absolutely friends of us at this point, and we talk to them or chat with them just about every day, you know, whether it's about Stompers stuff or not. You know, they will, we're sort of unofficial consultants, at least still, to the Stompers, if not in an official capacity. We've given our 2 cents on acquisitions this year. And, you know, of course I will always feel a very soft spot for the Stompers, and we'll always wish them the best, and we'll be following what they do very closely. And, you know, I will miss being involved with them on a day-to-day basis this year, but Sam and I are still very much plugged into the team.
That's very, very cool. Another question I have, a major theme in the book that keeps running through is team chemistry. And it just, mm-hmm. it keeps, particularly in the first 100 to 150 pages of the book, I think that that's something that perhaps Baseball Prospectus readers, sabermetricians, if you want to call us that, we overlook that a little bit because maybe we can't quantify that. I wanted to ask kind of, what did you learn in terms of the value of team chemistry, seeing it up close for, I don't know, 78 games in a season? Is it something we can't quantify? Is it something that's real? What are your thoughts?
It's tough. I think that was something we wanted to find out more about, just because we were going to have this unprecedented sort of access to the clubhouse and the dugout, and this was our chance to, you know, be in that situation that we're not normally in, and hopefully learn something about it. It's still a tough nut to crack. I mean, we could see how the mood in the clubhouse changed throughout the season, whether, you know, when the team was winning, everyone was thrilled. When the team was losing, everyone was upset. When we lost players to higher level leagues, that was demoralizing. And we were able to kind of quantify it in a way that most people aren't. We distributed surveys before every game to all the players. And, you know, we didn't get a perfect response rate on those, which is not surprising. But from what we did get, and we sort of presented the results of this in the book, it was clear that the players' self-reported mood did decline, did get worse as the season wore on, and maybe people got fatigued and the team was losing and we were losing players to upper level leagues. You could definitely see that players were reporting that they were in worse moods than they had been earlier in the season. Now, you know, whether it always comes down to the kind of chicken and egg, what came first, mood or performance. And I don't think we came to an answer there exactly, but we were very surprised by how quickly the mood could change, that, you know, a couple losses and suddenly people were a lot less happy-go-lucky, you know, little fights or confrontations or arguments would break out that never would have broken out when the team was winning. So you could definitely see the mood, but I think it's still somewhat mysterious how exactly the mood translates to the results on the field.
I know that you mentioned in there that there's a woman that used some kind of data to try to look at the fault lines, I believe was the term that was used in the book, for mm-hmm. personality clashes within the clubhouse. Do you think that that data or similar data, or there's data out there that could help quantify and make this better going forward? Or is this just one of those things that's going to slip through the cracks, so to speak?
Yeah, it's tough. It's definitely more resistant to analysis than many other areas. And I tend to think that, you know, it matters, but it probably doesn't matter as much as putting a good team together. It might still matter, you know, millions of dollars worth. And so it's definitely worth paying attention to and trying to get to the bottom of. I don't know if we're ever going to get to the point where we could, you know, assign a wins above replacement to a player's personality. That seems like something that we're not particularly close to doing, but I think it's possible that we could at least start to quantify things like, you know, do certain teams with certain ages or backgrounds or language barriers, you know, does that stuff get in the way of winning? And I think it's plausible that it could. You know, we had one player on our team, Gregory Polino, who was a starter, and he was from the Dominican, and at the beginning of the season didn't really speak much English, and he was just so isolated that it was hard to see. Later in the season, his English got a lot better, and we got some Spanish-speaking players, and he became more kind of integrated into the fabric of the team. But it was tough there for a while, and, you know, he was far from home, and he did get better as the season went on, and whether that had to do with feeling more comfortable, we don't know. But, you know, just seeing him sort of be on his own, you wanted to figure out a way to help him to, you know, help him feel more at home.
Makes total sense. Ben, I could talk to you about the book all night, but I'd like to jump into a little rapid fire if I could, just to be a little bit to move forward. So first question, I got to ask, what was your impression when you met Pony Guy?
We never actually met. I walked behind him taking pictures so that I could convince other people that this had actually happened. But yeah, that was my first Sonoma experience. I was just walking the streets going to look for a little cottage to spend the summer in, and there was a man wearing jorts and sandals and a giant knife walking a pony on a leash. And that was my first introduction to Sonoma. And I think it gave me a good sense of, you know, the sort of eccentric mix of people there and the strange sights that you would see. And I liked it. It was not the sort of thing that I see on the sidewalks of Manhattan.
I wonder if the pony on the leash was really necessary, like the pony was going to run away. But anyways.
You're right.
A little more serious question, if I can. What mulligan would you, and if you want to speak for Sam, what mulligan would you guys take if you could go back through the process?
For me personally, I mean, sure, there are players that I would, you know, sign or not sign or cut sooner. I look back and, you know, there are guys who are on our roster the whole season, and really there was no reason to think that they would suddenly get better, and we should have been more aggressive about recruiting new talent. And, you know, maybe part of it was just that it was hard to sign players, you know, because you had to not only dig through the spreadsheets and then try to track down these players, but then persuade them to, in some cases, fly across the country to play on this team in this league that they had never heard of. And that got harder and harder as the season went on and there was less schedule remaining. And so, you know, for that reason, and for the reason that it was hard to cut people that you liked and that you'd been spending time around, we were probably less aggressive than we should have been. And I think if we were to do it again, we would probably be a little more cutthroat, I think, about making roster decisions and things like that. And things like just, you know, taking control, you know, setting the lineup on day one instead of deferring to the manager, or at least making sure that we had some input in it just to set that precedent so that it was not a back and forth and, you know, this tiptoeing around that issue for the rest of the season. I think we could have saved ourselves some trouble that way. So those are the things that I would do differently if we were to do it again.
On the flip side, the smartest thing you or Sam did, either knowingly or unknowingly through the process?
Gosh, I mean, it's hard to find a better thing than, I mean, signing Sean Conroy just worked out on so many levels. I don't know what this book would be if not for Sean. I mean, so much of the story surrounds Sean, whether it's how he was going to be used, you know, whether he was going to be starting or closing, or then whether we could use him as a fireman and bring him in early in games. And that was kind of a cathartic moment when we finally managed to do that. And I mean, just having him around, I mean, he's a friend now. He was great to spend time with, and just, you know, the extra dimension of him being this trailblazer in baseball. I mean, that was the best thing we had accomplished without even intending to or knowing that we were. So that really made our year.
What was the best type of wine that you drank in Sonoma that last summer?
You know, I'm not really much of a drinker. I kind of don't distinguish between wines. I know red and white, and I like red better, but that's about as far as my sophistication goes. So, you know, my girlfriend Jessie was out there for the summer, and she took a little more advantage of that than I did. She went on some vineyard tours and I went on one, but I am not a connoisseur. I don't know what I'm looking for or what I'm tasting for. So I will sip whatever is put in front of me and then probably not finish it.
Good answer. Good answer. And final question I have for you is just favorite memory from the whole summer.
Oh, man. I think there were a couple of moments during the season that were just, you know, agonizing, but also extremely exciting. And there were just these couple moments during the season where something that we had planned for and advocated for weeks just came down to this one instant, essentially. And, you know, whether it would be the right move in the long run almost didn't matter because it needed to work the first time in order for us to be able to do it again. If it had backfired the first time, then we wouldn't have been able to convince people to do it again. And so I think, you know, the first time that we did use Sean as a fireman and brought him in very early in a game and had him finish that game, you know, we were convinced that that was the right thing to do. And even if we had lost that game, we would have been convinced that that was the right thing to do. But not everyone felt that way. And so it suddenly became very important that it did go our way this one time. And so Sam and I were just really, I mean, just on the edge of our seats, just white knuckling in the dugout, just on every pitch, on every out, in a way that I haven't been since I was a little kid. You know, when I watch baseball now, I'm usually not so invested in any outcome like that. And this was just so intense. You know, our project and our reputations and our book depended on it. So a moment like that, and I won't spoil the championship game for you because you're not quite there yet, but there is another moment that you will easily identify when you get to it, when we experienced really the whole range, the whole rainbow of emotions in a span of about 5 seconds. And I don't think either of us will ever forget that.
Mm. Well, Ben, I want to congratulate you first and foremost on a fantastic book. I mean, literally, I've read it almost cover to cover in a day, and I'm already planning on rereading it again this weekend. So congratulations to you. Congratulations to Sam. I hope he listens to this. And I really want to thank you for coming on. I want to give you a spot for your plugs. I really want to give you a spot to plug your Busboys and Poets event next week here in the D.C. area, and just, you know, where people can find you on Twitter, where they can find the book. Everything and anything you want to plug, please.
Yeah, so next Wednesday, May 11th, at the 5th Street Northwest Busboys and Poets, at 6:30 p.m., I'll be doing a Q&A that will be led by Barry Cervluga from the Washington Post and the author of The Grind. So I hope people will come out and ask questions and get books signed. That'll be fun. But more broadly, just for really any information about the book, we've been spending a lot of time building up the content at the book's website, which is the only rule is it has to work.com. And there is a ton of stuff on there. You can find excerpts, reviews, interviews, events, stats from the season, some sort of behind the scenes stuff. If you want to, you know, look at the stats website that we built for the Stompers, you can look at that. You can look at the spreadsheets that we generated for college players. And there's pictures of every player on the team, video of every player on the team, and video of some of the pivotal moments from the season, and tons of photos of things that you'll recognize once you read the book. So I really hope that people who enjoy the book will go on there, and I think you could probably spend hours on there looking at all the photos and videos and putting a face to many of the names that you've read in the book. So definitely check that out. And you know, for my other work, you can find me on Twitter at Ben Lindbergh, and if you follow me on there, you will see every podcast we post at BP and everything I write for 538.
Well, obviously, I'm a fantastic and big fan of your work. Thank you very much. You've always been such a great friend off the air to me and the site, so I want to thank you for that as well. And just sincerely, from the bottom of my heart, congratulate you on just a wonderful book and just a wonderful read. Great job to both of you guys.
Thank you. We appreciate your support as well, and it makes us really happy that people are enjoying the fruits of our labor here.
Can we buy tickets to the Busboys and Poets event, or is that a first-come, first-serve kind of a thing?
Yeah, I think you just show up and you get in.
All right. Well, I'm going to definitely try to make it out there if I can find a dog sitter. And I hope a lot of the audience joins me and brings a lot of questions and a lot of books.
Yeah, hope to see people down.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Ben, and I hope to see you maybe at Sabre Seminar this summer, if not somewhere around a ballpark.
All right. Good talking to you.
You too. Thank you so much. And that was episode 66 of the Nats GM Show with Ben Lindbergh from 538, from the Effectively Wild podcast, and from the best-selling book, The Only Rule Is It Has to Work. I cannot tell you how highly I recommend this book. I literally have read it in a day, and I want to reread it again. So please, 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 if you're listening to this, I'm sure you've already bought it, but if you haven't, please go check it out and buy it on Amazon and do yourself the favor. With that, episode 66 is a wrap. Bye for now.